A sermon on Palm Sunday because we're in Mark 15 and we had a Palm Sunday sermon 4 chapters ago in Mark 11 when we were there. At our Good Friday service this Friday at 7 p.m., we're planning to review the whole Passion Week narrative from Mark 1 through 15. So come out on Good Friday if you want to hear another Good Friday message. In C.S. Lewis's book, Till We Have Faces, C.S. Lewis tells a fictional story about a priest at a Greek temple for whom the story and the worship were all one in his mind. He thinks of his God being an outcast during the time of the year when he celebrates that, and of ruling during the time of the year when he celebrates that, and the priest in Lewis's story can't tell what's really happening. And I think C.S. Lewis is looking through that at Christians and saying, don't get confused and think that Jesus is actually dead every year on Good Friday and gone. We know that we're celebrating Easter, but every Sunday is a celebration of the resurrection, even through Lent. And you guys keep in your mind that Jesus is already risen and already reigning from heaven, even as we're hearing the story of Jesus dying and rising. Now, remember that Mark is Peter's story. It's told as a Passion Week narrative with a long introduction. The first 10 chapters cover 3 years. The last 6 chapters cover 8 days. And by Palm Sunday, Peter and the rest of the disciples and even the crowd and even the religious leaders are starting to get who Jesus is claiming to be, namely, the Christ, Messiah, anointed one, coming king. But they all expect a king who will conquer and rule. They don't expect a king who will suffer and serve. And by the end of Tuesday, after Palm Sunday, getting to Tuesday, Jesus has challenged everyone's ideas of what the Christ will be so much that one of Jesus' own disciples, Judas, says, I'm out. And he cashes in by selling Jesus to the chief priests. And last week we heard of his arrest, and we'll hear about his crucifixion today. We're also going to hear the story of the crowd. It's hard to know how the excited crowd of Palm Sunday turns into the murderous crowd of Good Friday. We'll take a look at that too. Seems like everyone agreed with Judas. Last week we heard the story of the Last Supper, Jesus' arrest and trial by the Jews from Mark 14. Today we'll hear the story of Jesus' trial and execution by the Romans from Mark 15. And as usual, Mark and Peter focus on action and abbreviate the story by summarizing the conversations and leaving out most of the direct dialogue. We'll get summaries of what Jesus and Pilate said to each other, not a he said, then he said, then he said, then he said, working our way through the story. Josephus gives us a brief description of Pilate's relationship with the Jews. I looked it up in my layman's translation of Josephus this week. When Pilate became the governor, up until that point, all of the governors of Judea had this policy of not putting up Caesar's flag or shields, which had Caesar's face on it, because the Jews said that's an image. Pilate became governor, and he brought all the flags and shields in during the middle of the night and put them up all around town, even at the temple. And then they woke up in the morning, and there's Caesar's face everywhere. And the crowds came into town, and they said, take them down. You have to take them down. And he said, no, you guys are subjects of Caesar. You have to have the flags. I'm the boss here. And if you won't submit to me, I will kill you. And the entire crowd laid down on the ground and rolled their shirts back so that Pilate could reach their necks more easily to chop their heads off. And Pilate went, oh, I can't kill everyone here. That doesn't look good on your resume if you kill off all of your subjects on the first day. So Pilate was used to having to handle riots between with the crowds. And the crowds knew that if they pushed Pilate far enough, through a riot, they could get what they wanted. So let's just keep that little story in mind as you look at the way that Pilate and the crowd relate to each other for the rest of this story. Pilate anchors Jesus' story to history. We don't just believe in a mythical story of Jesus dying. We believe Jesus died during this time that Josephus, a secular historian, writes about, and that the Apostles' Creed say Jesus suffered under Pontius Pilate. It really happened. Very early in the morning, the chief priests, with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin, reached a decision. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. In Mark 14, the Jews have already found Jesus guilty. Once they found him guilty, the soldiers beat him up and mock him a little bit. And now they've got to go to the secular authorities to get permission to execute Jesus. It's a little bit humiliating. The Jews don't have permission to execute anyone. They've got to ask Pilate to do it. We have the arrest notice of Jesus in the Jewish Mishnah that says Jesus is to be arrested on Passover Eve, and they're going to stone him. It's interesting that at the last minute, they decide to do this the legal way instead of just throwing rocks at him in the middle of the night. In Mark 14, Jesus is found guilty of blasphemy for claiming to be the Christ, the Son of God, the I Am, the Son of Man. But for the Roman trial, they're going to change the charge to treason. He's the king. That's why we should kill him. See, the Jews objected to Jesus' claim to be the Christ on religious grounds, but the Romans are going to object to Jesus' claim to be the Christ on political grounds. Jesus is led away. Isaiah 53 says that Jesus is led like a sheep to the slaughter silently. Watch how they're just leading Jesus around, and also watch how silently Jesus' lack of fighting with people while he's doing this impresses people, amazes people. Pilate's going to call it out here. Continuing in the story, Pilate says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked him, "Are you not going to answer? See how many things they're accusing you of." But still, Jesus made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. See, Pilate doesn't feel threatened by Jesus. Pilate isn't buying this story that he's a rebel who's about to take over his kingdom. From John 18, Pilate may have even understood Jesus' claim to be a king in a spiritual sense, because both from Jesus and the Jews, they eventually get around to talking about the original trial with the blasphemy charge. Pilate isn't threatened by Jesus. In fact, he's impressed. He's probably been a judge for quite a while and has never seen a prisoner who's so relaxed about this. That's amazing to him. Just as in Jesus' first trial, Jesus is willing to speak to the judge, but he's not fighting with the witnesses. The Jewish leaders look like they're bringing up all the same false accusations also of the first trial. Even though they weren't able to convict Jesus of them, they don't care. They're willing to bring all those things back up. Luke 23, Luke's the only one of the gospel writers who mentions that somewhere in this trial, they move from Pilate's palace to Herod's palace and back again. No one else mentions that part of the story. But Jesus is being condemned now by the official Roman government. Now, it was the custom at the feast to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the insurrectionists who had committed murder during the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate, knowing it was out of envy that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have Pilate release Barabbas instead. Now, it's unclear how this tradition of releasing a prisoner became part of Passover, but it makes some sense when you think about it, right? Passover is celebrating the time when the Jews gained their freedom from Egypt. So if you're going to have a feast where you celebrate by releasing a prisoner, Passover is the time to do it. And the crowd is introduced here as a separate character. It's almost like the Jewish leaders were there trying to get Jesus killed, and the crowd woke up that morning and came to Pilate to ask for their right of getting a prisoner released. And so now Pilate's going to play these two groups against each other, the crowd and the religious leaders. The crowd might be a little bit scared of Barabbas, actually. We don't know who he murdered in this uprising, whether it was a Roman or a Jew. The Jewish leaders are accusing Jesus of treason against Rome, but Barabbas has already been found guilty of that crime. Pilate is consistently calling Jesus the King of the Jews, I think, to get on the religious leaders' nerves here. He knows they don't want Jesus to be their leader. It's not clear how long this took, but somehow the religious leaders were able to convince the crowd to ask for Barabbas to be released instead of Jesus. And by making the choice between Barabbas or Jesus, the crowd has to choose how they will resist Rome. See, when they came to arrest Jesus in Mark 14, Jesus says, "Am I leading a rebellion?" And the answer is no. But Barabbas was. So the crowd has to choose whether they want to follow a leader like Barabbas, who's going to resist Rome by force, or a leader like Jesus, who's going to resist Rome by trusting God. And it looks like the crowd wants a leader who's more like Barabbas than Jesus. On Palm Sunday, when Jesus came into town, they wanted him to be the king who would come in and fight the Romans off. They wanted him to lead a rebellion, and he didn't. It's kind of a mystery, again, how this crowd could turn from the Palm Sunday crowd into the Good Friday crowd. But remember what Jesus has done since last Sunday. In Mark 11, he cleansed the temple, and he made it easier for foreigners to get into the temple. The foreigners are Romans. And then in Mark 12, Jesus talks about how bad the Jewish leaders are doing at representing God. And he even talks about God taking the vineyard away from them and giving it to someone else. And then in Mark 13, Jesus warns them that the temple's going to be destroyed. And that, after all those things, Judas, one of Jesus' own disciples, goes, "I don't think this is the kind of Messiah I was interested in following." And it seems like the crowd is doing the same thing, going, "You know, we'd rather follow someone like Barabbas, even though he scares us a little bit, than someone like Jesus." They don't want this kind of king. They wanted a leader of rebellion, not a loving sacrifice. "So what shall I do then with the one you call the King of the Jews?" Pilate asked them. "Crucify him," they shout. "Why, what crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to him. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. In Acts 3, when Peter is preaching a sermon in the temple, he says that the crowd disowned Jesus before Pilate, who had decided to let him go. In Matthew 27, it's clear that Pilate wants to satisfy the crowd since they're starting to riot. I don't know what the signs of a crowd starting to riot were back then, you know, pulling tires off of cars, lighting them on fire with gasoline. I don't know they didn't have very many cars back then. So whatever it was that was the sign that you could tell that a crowd was starting to get ready to riot was happening. And Pilate knew that, and it scared him. And he didn't want that to happen. He wanted to keep this crowd happy. Now, this time, the false accusations from the crowd didn't work to get a guilty verdict. So they just start chanting not the verdict they want, but the sentence they want. Kill him. Now, Pilate is able to win a minor battle while losing the war to keep Jesus alive here. See, Pilate makes the Jews acknowledge Jesus as their king in the process of giving the Jews permission to kill Jesus. In John 19, it's clear that the same Jews who didn't want to acknowledge Pilate or Caesar's right to rule over them as king have to concede the point by asking to kill their own king under Pilate's authority. They chose Caesar over their Messiah. And Pilate made it sure that they would have to do that. See, because Pilate can tell the story to the Jews and Romans alike from now on that Jesus really was attempting to make himself king and take over Jerusalem, and that the Jews turned their own king over to him for him to kill him. You see how Pilate is able to win this little victory over them? Now, the Jews have a 39 lash limit when you flog someone. The Romans have no limit. Jesus went through a Roman flogging here. And Jim Caviezel, who played Jesus in The Passion, something went wrong during the whipping scene, and Jim Caviezel got hit by the whip one time. And he said he grew in his respect for Jesus and how much Jesus avoided sin, even on the inside, while he was being beaten, because when Jim Caviezel got hit once, he said, all of the worst swear words I could think of came out of my mouth. They weren't even going through Jesus' mind. Jesus was going through this sinlessly. So the soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that's the praetorium, and they called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. Following his Roman conviction, just like his Jewish conviction, they hand him over to the soldiers to beat him up and mock him a little bit, and then they flog him. So Jesus had two beatings and a flogging within a couple of hours here. It's no wonder that they're going to have someone else carry the cross for him. This crown of thorns that they put on Jesus' head, they've tried to identify what type of thorn it was, and the reason it's so challenging is you have more thorns in a small area in Palestine than almost anywhere in the world. There was plenty of thorns for them to use. A commentator I read this week said something I'd never thought of before. Do you remember that the thorns were part of the curse in Genesis 3? See, these thorns weren't just hurting Jesus. They made a crown out of the curse and put it on his head. And even this is part of Jesus bearing the curse for our sin, is that his crown, when he was crowned the King of the Jews, was a crown of thorns. Mark 15:21. A man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. When they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he would not take it, and they crucified him, dividing up his clothes. They cast lots to see what each would get. I just started thinking about the Ten Commandments and how Jesus is being sinned against here. See, he's God, so he's being blasphemed. They're using God's name in vain here. They just robbed him. It's not good enough that they kill him. They just stole everything he had. Of course, they're murdering him. They've had false witnesses testifying against him all day. This isn't just lying. This is the type of lying that's specifically in the Ten Commandments. Don't bear false witness against your neighbor. They're doing this because they're jealous of Jesus, which is coveting. Everyone around Jesus is sinning, and Jesus is not. It's amazing. Now, Simon of Cyrene, the fact that we get so many details about him probably means that Mark and Peter, and probably even the people who get the letter that they're writing, know him. He's probably a believer. In fact, he probably traveled from Africa for the Passover and is staying outside of Jerusalem just like Jesus is doing, coming into town every day and spending the night outside the city. He comes into town. The Romans have the right to make anyone carry anything they want for a mile. And so they give him Jesus' cross. People from Cyrene are there at Pentecost in Acts 2. They have their own synagogue in Jerusalem, according to Acts 6. The first missionaries who took the gospel to Gentiles were from Cyprus and Cyrene. They're the ones who planted the church at Antioch, where Paul is sent as a missionary to the rest of the world. In fact, one of the main elders there is from Cyrene. The other guy's name is Simon from Niger. Guess what? It might be the same guy. He might have ended up being an elder at Paul's church that sent Paul on the first missionary journey. Rufus is mentioned in Romans 16 at the end. Probably his son is a leader in the church in Rome. At any rate, it looks like, by all accounts, Simon of Cyrene believed in Jesus because of this event. Now, they tried to give Jesus some wine mixed with myrrh. This is drugged wine. It's not clear whether they're doing this to be mean to Jesus or whether they're doing this to be nice to Jesus. It seems unlikely that the Roman soldiers are going, "Here, Jesus, have some Tylenol before we put you onto the cross." Some have even speculated that maybe one of the women there, spiked the wine and said, "Here, give him this. This will make him feel better." We don't know for sure what's going on. At any rate, Jesus says, "I'm not going to drink it. I need all my wits about me while I do this." In Psalm 22, it talks about casting lots for his clothes. It's appropriate for us to start thinking Psalm 22. Jesus is about to quote it. "It was the third hour when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, 'The King of the Jews.' They crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. And those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, 'So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself.' In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. 'He saved others,' they said, 'but he can't save himself. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe.' Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him." According to Mark 15, Jesus was crucified at the third hour. According to John 19, Jesus was condemned to be crucified at the sixth hour. So any of you who can do math will see the problem there. See, Mark counts from sunrise, so his third hour is 9 a.m., John did this weird thing. I don't know if you've ever heard anyone doing this, but he actually started counting at midnight and counted the hours from there. Know anyone else who does that? Yeah? Okay. We do. So John's sixth hour is probably about 6 a.m. So his trial, where they condemned him to death, wrapped up about 6 a.m., and then by 9, he's being crucified. Now, all four Gospels summarize and translate the exact wording of the sign over Jesus' head slightly differently. It was written in multiple languages, and none of the Gospels have it exactly the same way, but it's all the same message, which is that Jesus is the King of the Jews. That's what the sign said. Jesus was being executed for being the King of Israel. Remember, the leaders who mock him, they say, "See this Christ, this King of Israel." That's their definition of the Christ, the King of Israel, David's son, the one who was coming. Mark points out many different groups that mocked Jesus. The soldiers mocked Jesus. The passers-by mocked Jesus. The Jewish leaders mocked Jesus. The robbers being executed with Jesus mocked Jesus. We're going to see this, that the centurion here has a change of heart. In Matthew 27, it actually says the soldiers, plural, were impressed with who Jesus was and changed their mind. In Luke 23, one of the robbers who's being crucified with Jesus has a change of heart. It's possible here in Mark that Mark's just saying, listing the robbers as a group, that both of them weren't mocking Jesus. It's just as likely that both of them started out mocking Jesus and one of them had a change of heart. We've got an example of that in the soldiers. These robbers, this word for robber can also mean rebel. This is probably political robbers. These guys are like Barabbas. They've committed crimes that are intentionally political in nature. They're actually being executed for the crime of treason that they're accusing Jesus of. The passers-by here know the false accusation that Jesus said he was going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. In John, it's clear that Jesus was talking about his own body, the true temple, that he's going to destroy it. Or rather, the others are going to destroy it, and he's going to rebuild it in 3 days. But Jesus also did warn the people that the temple would be destroyed, and these two ideas may have gotten mixed up in their minds. Jesus never threatened to destroy the temple. He told them it would happen. Now, Don Carson points out that there's some truth, ironic truth, in both of these things that they say about Jesus here. Because Jesus really is, they really are destroying the temple of Jesus' body, and he really is going to rebuild it in 3 days. But they don't know that. And they say, you saved others, but you can't save yourself. It's true. Jesus could have saved himself, but if he would have done that, he wouldn't have saved us. Even then, there's truth in what they're saying. They just don't know it. So at the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. That would be from noon to three. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing near heard this, they said, listen, he's calling Elijah. One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. Now this darkness may have included an eclipse and or a storm, but 3 hours is a long time for complete darkness. It makes me think of the supernatural darkness from the plagues on Egypt in Exodus 10. In 2 Peter 2, this is how Peter describes some people who are going to go to hell. He says, blackest darkness is reserved for them. You see, this was an eclipse of God's face shining in blessing on Jesus. This is judgment, and the darkness is a picture of that. You remember number 6, the blessing that Moses gave to the people? The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. The opposite of this is happening to Jesus right now. In the Apostles' Creed, we say that Jesus descended into hell, and there's some argument about how we should understand that. I was helped this week to think of this idea, that Jesus descended into the same judgment as hell before he died. Jesus is experiencing hell here on the cross. This isn't the absence of God's presence. This is the absence of God's favor. God's there, and he is not pleased. He is treating Jesus as though he deserves to be punished for all of our sins. Jesus really did descend into death, Hades, the place of the dead, but he told the thief on the cross next to him that he'd be with him in paradise. But here, before he died, Jesus experienced the full brunt of God's judgment, and he did it for us. Peter says in 1 Peter 3:18, for Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. Now, by quoting this verse, Jesus quoted the verse from Psalm 1. They didn't have references at the beginning of their, they wouldn't have called it Psalm 22, but you can refer to a psalm by the first verse. Jesus may have been saying, read Psalm 22. But he also may have been praying this and feeling this, that God is forsaking him. In Psalm 22:1, talks about being forsaken. Psalm 22:15 talks about being thirsty. Psalm 22:18 talks about the robe being stolen from Jesus. And in Psalm 22:24, it talks about the fact that God did not ultimately, finally hide his face from Jesus. This was temporary. And once he had borne our sin, God was with him. Now, I wasn't able to follow this everywhere, but I can't find a single example of Jesus ever praying to God using a name other than Father to talk to God, except for here. It's the only time I can find when Jesus is praying to God and not calling him Father. He's feeling distant. He's feeling punished because he is being punished. Now, how could you turn Eloi, Eloi into Elijah, Elijah? And the answer is probably that even this is part of the mocking. They know what Jesus said. They're just trying to twist it into something else. And the drink they give him is definitely part of the mocking. Who drinks vinegar? And who has vinegar with them? Like, does anyone have vinegar on them right now? Like, no? There's a strong argument that this is probably a cleaning supply. Where did they get a sponge from? They're not offering Jesus a real drink. They're giving him something he can't drink as part of making fun of him. And with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, the younger, and of Joseph and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women had come up with him to Jerusalem and were also there. This loud cry is all, in Matthew and Mark, the my God, why have you forsaken me are the only words of Jesus we get. Luke and John give us some more. He may have cried out, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit," the last words Jesus said in Luke. He may have said, "It is finished," here from John. But Mark's point seems to be that Jesus said something, cried out, and then he died. Like he's choosing to die. And he's showing, "I'm dying now," and he dies. Even now, Jesus is giving his life. It's not being taken from him. These women who cared for Jesus, maybe it was safer for them to be here, but they seem brave. They seem braver than the guys at this point in the story. If you take the lists from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they're overlapping, and they're all describing the same three women, this may not be the case because there was other women, but probably Salome is the mother of Zebedee's sons, who is also described in John as Jesus' mother's sister, which means James and John might have been Jesus' cousins. Again, they could have been three different women, but probably this is the same woman. At any rate, we've got moms of the disciples there at the cross. At least two of them, probably three, maybe four of them. The curtain of the temple ripped. The way to God is open because of Jesus' death. The temple is beginning to fall apart, just like Jesus said it would. It's no longer necessary. In Hebrews 10, it says that we enter the holy place through Jesus' sprinkled blood and the curtain, which is his broken body. When Jesus died on the cross, his body broke and the curtain ripped at the same time. And now we get into God's presence through Jesus. The fact that the centurion called Jesus the Son of God, that was the definition of Christ from the first trial. This centurion has probably been Jesus' guard all day long. He's seen the whole thing. He's been involved, or at least overseen, the mocking of Jesus all these times. And he changes his mind about who Jesus is. And he goes from mocking Jesus to revering him. So it was preparation day. That's the day before the Sabbath. So as evening approached, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked him if Jesus had already died, and when he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. So Joseph brought some linen cloth, took down the body, wrapped it in linen, and placed it in a tomb cut out of the rock. Then he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. Evening's approaching on preparation day. This is probably 3 p.m. Friday. Bodies can't be hung overnight according to Jewish law. Deuteronomy 21, that same section that gives you a limit of the number of lashes you can give someone when you're whipping them. Joseph of Arimathea is described as waiting for the kingdom of God, like he believed Jesus was the king. Not sure anyone believed during this weekend. They needed Jesus' resurrection to renew their belief, but Joseph was one of these believers. Arimathea is Ramah, Samuel's town. It's close to Jerusalem. Joseph of Arimathea, according to Matthew, is a rich man. He's a prominent member of the council. He's prominent enough that he knows Pilate. Pilate isn't surprised to see him. He's prominent enough he can walk into Pilate, ask for the body. He's bold. He's willing to risk associating with Jesus. They quickly hurry out and buy some strips of cloth to wrap Jesus' body in. They put a stone in front of the entrance. It's a final burial. They don't expect Jesus to be coming back. And I have one retraction from last week's sermon. I said that Mary of Bethany was the only one who got to anoint Jesus' body for burial. But John tells us one other person got in on it. Nicodemus shows up at the last minute and puts some spices on Jesus' body with this linen strips. But the other women, at least two of them, see where Jesus is buried, and they're going to come back after the Sabbath is over to finish anointing Jesus' body, put the rest of the spices on. And that's where the story ends. In the movie Hook, at the beginning, Peter Pan has grown up, and he's seeing his kids going, sending other people to videotape their baseball games and their plays. And Peter Pan's wife, tells him, "Peter, you're missing it." I think those words are really appropriate. I think Peter would have appreciated hearing that during this time. "Peter, you're missing it." There's so many people who are missing it. This is the most significant event in all of history, all of human history. God's taking away the sins of the world, and the people who are walking by are missing it. They're mocking Jesus. The soldiers who are killing Jesus are missing it. They're mocking Jesus. The religious leaders are missing it. The disciples have run away. They're missing it. No one is getting this. You're missing it. And I think we're in danger here too of reading this story and missing it. Don't miss it. Some of these people got it when they reflected on it. The soldiers changed their mind. One of the robbers changed their mind. After the fact, the disciples changed their mind. The crowds at Pentecost changed their mind. Peter said later on that Jesus died as the Son of God, the King of the Jews, to save us from our sin if we trust in Him and enter God's presence through Jesus' shed blood and broken body. And let's not live like Jesus ceased to exist either when He died or went back to heaven. This week, Jesus is not dying again. We're remembering it. Jesus is already risen, and He's already reigning with God from heaven. And remember that God gave the full brunt of His wrath to Jesus. He didn't look on Jesus graciously on the cross. He didn't have His face shine upon Him. He didn't give peace to Jesus while He was on the cross. But if you're like me, you know that Jesus didn't get what He deserved, but Jesus got what I deserved. And the good news is that because of that, because Jesus took our curse, we get Jesus' blessing. If you trust in Jesus, then the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn His face towards you and give you peace, because He gave Jesus the opposite of those things instead of you. Heavenly Father, thank You.